Since Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022, Democrats are pushing hard against pro-life Republicans, charging them as extremists who would force women who are sexually assaulted to carry the child of their rapist. And we've seen it here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, particularly in last governor's race. But are pro-life Republicans the real extremists? Joining us to talk further about the politics of the pro-life position is Alexandra DeSantis, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a contributing writer to National Review. She's also the co-author of Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing, which is now in its second edition. Alexandra, welcome to the Commonwealth Matters.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just a few days ago, there was a memo from the National Republican Congressional Committee says that pro-life Republicans have a brand problem and not a policy problem. And in part, I'm sure you've read the memo, but in part, it says that candidates who are pro-life must confidently articulate their views, emphasize empathy towards new mothers, and then highlight Democrats' abortion radicalism. So if Republican candidates had this memo and this advice during the midterm elections in 2022, of course, they're being blamed for not being able to articulate a pro-life position then. Do you think that the results might have been different?
You know, I do think so. It would depend on how well candidates actually heeded the letter and what tack they took. You know, I don't know that it was really specific enough in terms of what exactly this looks like in every race, how you might respond to every attack. You know, it needs a bit more substance that people like myself and others at EPPC, for example, are trying to put together to help out candidates who really want to talk about this well, who are sincerely pro-life, but just aren't sure of the best way to talk about it, because they're really playing on the other side's terms most of the time. And I think that's why we've seen these big losses. The media really is in the tank, unfortunately, for the pro-abortion cause. And so we always start out with one arm tied behind our back as pro-lifers. And most politicians, even if they are really pro-life, they're just not equipped with the best messaging. And so you see a lot of either silence from people who aren't sure how to talk about it effectively, or, you know, occasionally just comments that are not describing the pro-life stance in a compelling and compassionate way.
Yeah, we saw this, as I mentioned in the intro, in our governor's race. We have perhaps one of the most pro-abortion Democratic governors in the country, strong pro-life challenger Daniel Cameron, very principled on the life issue. He showed his colors when he was attorney general, defended every single pro-life law. He was against any exceptions. He saw that child as worthy of protection, regardless of how that child was conceived. And yet he got beat up for being the extremist. What the Democrats found was a young woman in far west Kentucky, Hadley Duvall, who really a heartbreaking situation where she was sexually assaulted by her stepfather starting at the age of 12, eventually conceived a couple years later. Now she miscarried, but she did this ad, a testimonial that said, you know, Daniel Cameron can never know, could never understand what I went through, nor should he tell me that I shouldn't have had an abortion or had the possibility of an abortion. That message resonated across the state. It was carried on television stations for at least a couple months in the bigger cities. And there was no response to that. The pro-life community wasn't ready to respond. The Cameron campaign, I don't know if they knew what to say, but they didn't respond. Eventually, the Commonwealth Policy Center and many of our listeners and viewers saw the ad that we ran. In response to that, we found a young woman who was conceived in rape, and she shared her story and was grateful that her mother saw her as a human being that deserved life. So that was a response, and that did get some traction, but we didn't have the amount of funding to get that out far and wide. And quite frankly, that original messaging by the pro-abortion side really took hold. And you know how it is, Alexandra, that if you repeat something over and over, and if you have widespread coverage, it's very difficult to win back people to your side. So I just said a lot there, but where do let's just focus on the rape and incest exceptions. This seems to be one of the more difficult places for pro-life Republicans to message on. Where do they begin with that?
Yeah, well, of course, it's a tricky topic because we, you know, pro-lifers are 100% against, you know, sexual abuse of women. We're, we should always be willing to condemn those types of acts. There should be full punishment for whoever does that. It's a horrible thing for that to happen to any woman. And yet we can say at the same time, and we do say, that that evil isn't, kind of ameliorated by taking the life of a child who might result. That child, kind of, as you said in that follow-up ad, that child is still a human being with the same rights as you or I, the same dignity, the same right to life as any other human being, regardless of the circumstances in which he or she came into the world. But I think for politicians, that's a difficult needle to thread, because stories like that of the young woman in the first ad are heartbreaking, and rightly so. And people look at that and think, well, of course, this woman shouldn't have to carry a child that came into the world this way. Of course, she should be able to do whatever she needs to do to feel better. And so it's hard for Republicans to kind of grapple with that. They might prefer to just avoid the issue altogether and not have to talk about it and hope people don't notice. And that's typically what we see. But I think that the best way to talk about it is first to say kind of what I just said, that of course we know this is always a grave evil that happens to women, and we can condemn it. But at the same time, why does that child have to pay? Why should the child suffer for the evil that his or her father committed? And on top of that, it doesn't solve the violence that was done to that woman for her to turn around and consent to an act of violence against her own child. She is not any less violated. She is not any less harmed for turning around and then participating in an act of violence. In fact, she is harmed even more by then taking that out on her own innocent child. And as difficult as those situations are, certainly we shouldn't minimize it. She's not better off for choosing abortion.
Yeah, no, that's good. And I think that's something that needs to be talked about, that once somebody's wronged, allowing that person who's wronged to perpetrate another wrong or another harm isn't helping the situation. I remember growing up, my parents would say, two wrongs don't make a right. Doesn't justify you in doing something that's wrong. I think part of the conversation too needs to be in the actual harm that abortion does to women. And this is really, as I've observed news stories and institutional organizations that look at this, they've suppressed it. I mean, we know there have been some studies done on women who've had abortion that look at their mental health, their emotional health, their relationships. We do know that it harms women. Can you speak to that? And of course, you wrote a book about this, how abortion solves nothing and harms everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the most rigorous chapters in our book is the chapter looking at how abortion harms women. I think this is the foremost argument for abortion from the other side, is that women need abortion, and that, you know, even if maybe this does take a human life, we have to be okay with it as a society because women are better off. And in fact, that's not the case. And we look at it from several angles. One of the big ones is, as you mentioned, the ways in which abortion harms women who have abortions. That could be physical complications, so kind of immediate short-term ill effects, particularly in cases of, surgical abortions gone wrong, or chemical abortions, these pills taken in the privacy of the home where women suffer complications and don't necessarily know how to get the follow-up care they need, psychological complications. So long-term, all the best studies and meta-analyses have found that women do have much higher rates of all kinds of mental health distress after having abortions. Now, is that to say every single woman? Of course not. But there's no question that women who have abortions have much higher rates of suicidal ideation, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, et cetera. And no wonder, right? Because factually speaking, they are participating in taking their own child's life. How could that not have negative psychological consequences for many women? But we also talk a bit about how abortion just harms women in general, even women who don't have abortions, because it pushes this kind of, we refer to it as a male normative view. So the idea that kind of the male body is the standard, and things like pregnancy and childbearing are kind of odd or off or problematic. And so we kind of have to sideline that in order for women to be able to be equal to men. We saw this even in the Supreme Court's own reasoning in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, for example, where they argue women rely on abortion. Women can't succeed without abortion. And this narrative is everywhere. That's at the root of why so many Americans support abortion. They really think women can't succeed without it.
And that's a shame. You know, I think of the feminist movement, which first wave feminism brought a lot of advances for women, where they could vote, they could be recognized in legal contracts, certain things that they were denied early on, but they were also pro-life as well, the first wave feminists. And if you think about one of the most feminine things that could be done is to bear a child, to care for a child, to nurse a child. And yet the third wave feminists, or whatever phase that we're in now of feminism, that's not considered to be feminine, to bear children, to care and nurture children, is it?
Well, yeah, I think a big part of it is now we have this vision of kind of human life or human fulfillment as being, we make our own identity, we make our own fulfillment, our own happiness. And if mine doesn't include having a baby and I, you know, want to have uncommitted sex with whomever and get pregnant, obviously we need abortion, right? If we as a society now think that equality includes participating in sex with whomever and having, you know, no consequences at all or no responsibilities to any child who might come into the world as a result, of course we're going to think women need abortion because men are able to walk away from pregnancy in a way that women can't without abortion. And interestingly, you know, you mentioned the first wave feminists. This is why they were all pro-life, because they realized that same kind of fundamental inequality, we might say, between how men and women experience reproduction, right? Women get pregnant and men don't. But they didn't see this as a case for abortion. They argued this meant we needed a society that supports women, a society that doesn't kind of let men off scot-free when women get pregnant, but require men to support women. And pro-lifers today are saying the same thing. Look, abortion doesn't equalize anything. Abortion doesn't help women. It just has them turn around and commit violence against their own vulnerable child to somehow try to be on equal footing with men.
That's right. Further pointing to some of the inconsistencies in the feminist movement of today, I've had guests on and we've talked about women being erased. Gender ideology wants to make men and women the same. And when it comes to private spaces like bathrooms and locker rooms or girls' sports teams, female sports teams, but also the term, also the idea of pregnancy. It used to be widely acknowledged that it's just women who could get pregnant. And now the term is being used today, people able to bear children. They're not using women anymore, but as people able to bear children, which we know it's always going to be a female that can bear women. So just the change in the terminology indicates where our culture is and how we think about feminism and women and childbearing. And this is happening very quickly, isn't it? These changes in terminology, changes in thinking about men and women and the differences, which throws a curve at us, doesn't it, in the pro-life movement?
Very much so. I mean, I often say in my talks these days, I talk about, you know, women become pregnant and men don't. And that's why we see feminists trying to, you know, argue for some form of equality here. And they see that as being abortion and we as pro-lifers don't. And I always say, you know, we in this room probably agree women become pregnant and men don't, but that isn't necessarily a point of consensus in our society anymore. You know, we hear terms, you talk about changing terminology. Now we're supposed to say chest feeding instead of breastfeeding. I mean, it's appalling the idea that men can just be women if they want to. I kind of refer to it as the new progressive patriarchy, right? The idea that men can do anything, including be a woman.
So things are changing quickly. I want to talk about a couple of recent developments. Let's talk about medication abortions, abortion pills. There's a case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court right now. Study just came out yesterday that said that this is from the Alan Guttmacher Institute. This is the research arm of Planned Parenthood. They said that medication abortions accounted for 63% of all U.S. abortions in 2023. And this is the drug mifepristone. And the FDA has approved it for use up to 10 weeks of pregnancy. And this can be sent to patients after a telehealth appointment, can be sent through the mail. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court is looking into whether the FDA really had authority to justify that or to allow that drug to be used for the termination of a life in the womb. But here's a question. How is chemical abortion, in particular through the mail, where women do a telehealth checkup and then get it sent to their own home, how is this in particular changing the abortion debate? Because we're talking about a drug that's sent, women do it in the privacy of their own homes. They don't have to go to an abortion center. How is this changing the abortion debate? 63% of all abortions done last year were done through chemical abortions.
Yeah, well, it's definitely changed the playing field, right? Because if you think about post-Roe, the idea was for as many states as possible to limit or eliminate abortion. It's a lot harder to do that when women can go online and essentially just order a chemical abortion through the mail. Now, in many states, you would still theoretically have to talk to a doctor of some kind, but the other side is pushing even the envelope on that. They want to have, you know, a nurse or physician's assistant or basically a pharmacist just be able to kind of give this drug. They want it over the counter even for women to just be able to have this whenever, not to have to see a doctor in person. That was one of the most recent relaxed safety standards during COVID. The FDA suddenly permitted women not to have to even go to see a doctor in person before getting chemical abortion drugs. And this is really dangerous for women. So on the one hand, on the policy hand, so to speak, if you're trying to limit abortions, it's a lot harder to do if women can get them via the mail, obviously. That's why you see abortions going up even in the wake of Dobbs. But secondly, this is a really big health risk for women. Obviously, the biggest problem here is that it kills an unborn child. But secondly, women's health and life in many cases are at risk because of taking these drugs without seeing a doctor. They often misjudge how far along they are. They might take it far too late in pregnancy for it to be safe for them. They might have an ectopic pregnancy and not know about that. There are certainly mental health complications that come along with chemical abortion that are not really talked about very much. You know, being the one who administers the abortion to yourself, perhaps even seeing your child, you know, as you pass the child into the toilet. I mean, these, it's horrible to talk about. It's quite graphic, but these are the things women are doing when they take these drugs. Of course, that has a really negative psychological effect on women long term.
We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, my name is Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're here to shore up the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, natural marriage, and sound fiscal policies. At the Commonwealth Matters, we have conversations with leading thinkers and policymakers to help us think biblically about the great issues of the day. If you appreciate our work, then please consider a donation today. This work is entirely supported by people just like you. Your gifts and tax-deductible contributions help to underwrite this program, and you help to get this important message out all across the Commonwealth. We believe that the Commonwealth of Kentucky is a great place to live, and we want to keep it that way for our families and our children. That's why we're standing for what's right, for what's good, and what's true right here in Kentucky. Thanks in advance for your support, and may God bless you. If you're just joining us, you're tuned into the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, your host, here with Alexandra DeSanctis, and we are talking about the politics of abortion, which is a timely topic as we head into the 2024 general presidential election. Here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, we have 100 state House seats on the ballot, half of the state Senate seats are on the ballot, other offices will be voted on as well. Alexandra, I want to go back to the politics of it. Donald Trump was in the news yesterday, and he has backed down on pro-life position. Of course, to his credit, we need to acknowledge that he appointed 3 pro-life justices to the U.S. Supreme Court, which allowed for the Dobbs decision to be handed down, which struck down Roe v. Wade as the law of the land, which I think we'd all agree that that was a good thing. However, Donald Trump is advocating for abortion being allowed up to 15 weeks. That's what he said in an interview yesterday. And he's also for exceptions. He thinks that there should be exceptions for rape and for incest. What does this do to the pro-life movement? Traditionally, pro-lifers have voted Republican because Republicans have been the pro-life party. But what do you see happening to the pro-life movement as they head into the ballot box in November later this year?
Well, I think the movement is quite fractured, and we've seen that even post-Dobbs. You know, that for the past 50 years, everyone's been very united around the fact that we had to get rid of Roe. And with Roe out of the room, you know, that's a wonderful victory and we should celebrate it. There's a lot less unity about what exactly we're supposed to be doing now. And so you see people like Trump saying comments like that on one hand, and then on the other hand, you have some people arguing that nothing less than a total abortion ban at the national level with no exceptions would be acceptable tomorrow. And so I think we should, you know, we can use his comments as a way to clarify, should a pro-life politician vote for a 15-week ban if one's available? Certainly, right? Are there cases where it might be politically prudent to put exceptions into a bill? Yeah, maybe so. If you can get a very pro-life law by compromising on that, sure. Now, we ought to do it while always saying children before 15 weeks are just as much human and have as much right to life. And we're going to keep working towards a bill that recognizes that over time, or, you know, children conceived in a situation of rape are just as much of, you know, human beings, as we talked about earlier, and have the right to life. We should always be very clear about that, that our eventual goal is to protect all unborn children. But there's nothing wrong with supporting something politically prudent or pragmatic that isn't exactly the bill we want. However, that is not to say, oh, we'll just, you know, settle at 15 weeks and call it good and we can all move on. That is not at all the pro-life message. That's never been what pro-lifers have argued. And nobody who's seriously pro-life is going to support that, right? That's more liberal than most countries in Europe. So I don't think that's going to be a reasonable stopping point for anyone who's a real pro-life voter.
Well, on top of it, when you consider the trend that more women are taking pills, pursuing chemical abortions, and that these are done 10 weeks or earlier, 15 weeks really doesn't mean anything, does it?
No, that's exactly right. And in fact, I think something like 93% of abortions take place in the first 15 weeks of pregnancy. So again, protecting any human lives we can is great. If Congress can pass a 15-week bill now, that'd be a lot better, right? A lot of states have abortion on demand until birth, and a national law stopping abortions at 15 weeks would save a lot of babies. That's not something to kind of sneeze at, but it's also not, let's pack up and go home. We've gotten the job done.
That's right. Let's speak about what Dobbs did in relation to a 15-week ban. And I want to make sure I am understanding what Trump said was he's talking about, of course, he's running for president. That's a national office. So my assumption is that that's a national bill in Congress. But getting back to Dobbs, that essentially handed abortion policy back to the states. So what's your take on whether or not Congress can pass a national right to life legislation? Is it possible? Did Dobbs leave that possibility open?
I do think so. I think the decision was actually really intentionally clear to say the people and their elected representatives, and not explicitly only state government. So I think there certainly is room under the majority opinion in Dobbs for Congress to legislate on this. Now, whether or not it's politically prudent to pass a particular type of bill now versus later, or whether the votes are there, that's a very different question. But I do think that Congress has the authority under the ruling to pass a pro-life law.
Very good. And of course, you think of the blue states, the left-leaning states like California, Illinois, New York, they have enacted pro-abortion protections. Michigan, another state, Ohio just recently put in provisions into their state constitution that says that abortion is a fundamental right. If there was a national law passed, don't you think that that would further galvanize the pro-abortion side and get them to come out in force? I'm just thinking strategy here. How would that work? Because you and I think strategy. We think of course, we start from the place of principle, Alexandra. We also think about how best to move that principle into policy. And we've got to be careful how we think about this. We've got to be careful how we think of the other side responding. Part of this equation, too, is that the other side seems to be able to raise all kinds of money. They, here in Kentucky, when we had the Amendment 2 issue on the ballot, we were outraised by 10-1. They raised over $10 million. Our side raised $1 million. And we've seen this in Ohio. It was about a 2-1 margin. The other side, pro-abortion side, raised over $20 million. Pro-life side raised about $10 million. We are outraised, outspent, in some cases outmessaged. And what I want to drill in here is being strategic as we advance a policy. And I'm curious, again, getting back to national policy, is there a downside to Congress voting on a 15-week ban or an 8-week ban or whatever it might be?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right to point to the funding discrepancies, because at the end of the day, what the American people are willing to support or what they think they know about abortion is what's going to set policy. Ultimately, that's just how our governmental system works. And so we have to be serious about that as pro-lifers. We can't. That's kind of why I derisively mentioned, a total ban with no exceptions tomorrow. That would be great if we had a country where that was politically feasible, but we don't. And we have to take that seriously. Now, as to whether a national law would be a setback, I think it depends on what pro-lifers are pushing for. I think a 15-week bill is actually pretty in line with what the average American thinks. Most Americans do want some limits on abortion. And, you mentioned these different ballot measures that have gone consistently in the pro-abortion direction. I think the other side has been really successful at pretending like abortion is an all or nothing question. They've been really good at turning it through these ballot amendments into all abortions until birth, which they don't describe that way, if they can help it in their messaging, or no abortions at all, no matter what, including, women dying in healthcare emergencies, which is not something any pro-lifer is advocating, not something any pro-life law is going to allow to happen. Women can always be cared for in healthcare emergencies. And so in that all or nothing situation, even an American who would say, wow, 15-week bill sounds just about right for me, or even a little bit too liberal, they're going to say, well, geez, I don't want women dying in healthcare emergencies, so I better vote for this amendment, or whatever the case might be. I think that's why we're getting the results we're getting, because all or nothing is not favorable to pro-lifers. It's very favorable to the other side, even though most Americans are closer to our view. So all this to say, if you can strike the balance of a national bill that actually is, pretty liberal compared to most of the world and where a lot of Americans come down, and you can message about it effectively and not let the other side turn it into a they want women to die kind of thing, I think that would not really cause much political, blowback for the average American. depending on how it's messaged. And that's the big caveat, because like you say, if you're outspent at every turn and they have, you know, really effective ads like the one we talked about earlier, well, a 15-week bill might sound quite different coming from the mouth of the other side.
I want to reiterate what you said in an article you wrote at National Review some time ago. You said that nearly 3/4 of Americans say that they want abortion to be totally illegal, to be permitted only when a mother's life is at risk or she's been raped, or to be illegal after the first trimester. You go on to say that the supermajority of Americans has far more in common with the GOP platform than with Democrats, who oppose safety policies for chemical abortion drugs and parental notification for minors seeking abortions, and who favor a federal right to taxpayer-funded abortion for any reason throughout pregnancy. The way you put it right there is the majority. That's the majority position of Americans. And I think the challenge is for Republicans to articulate that, to getting back to what we started out with, who's the real extremist in the pro-life debate today? Is it the Republican who's principled and sees that all life worthy of protection, including that very vulnerable life that was conceived in rape? Or is it the side that says that abortion should take place up to the 9th month or even after birth for any reason? Federal funding of abortion, no restrictions on chemical abortions, no notification for minors seeking abortion? Or is that the radical position? I think we agree that is the case, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And one point I like to make here is who are the incrementalists, right? By and large, Republicans are willing to vote for something that most Americans support, even as we continue to work towards, you know, a total pro-life law at some point, you know, if the culture in our country ever get to that point where that's politically feasible. There aren't many Republicans coming out right now saying we must have a total ban tomorrow. That's a very minority position, even among the pro-life movement. I think most people realize that's just not going to happen right now. In some states, it's possible, but in many, it's not. Nationally, it's not. And so we're willing to say, look, we'll meet you where you are, Americans. We think you should be closer to our position, but we don't have to have everything we want tomorrow. Democrats are not doing that. Democrats are not saying, look, 20 weeks would be fine with us. No, they want absolutely everything. They want it now, and they're not going to compromise. And I think, unfortunately, Republicans are pretty good at talking about Democratic extremism. They're getting better. Like you mentioned, it's in that memo that we should talk about extremism, certainly. But we haven't seen that paired with, here's what we stand for and why. We typically see that paired with, oh, we don't really know what policy we want. We just want it to be pro-life. We'll get back to you, right? That's what we hear from Republicans. So no wonder the other side is confused, because Democrats won't admit to being extremists. They talk about it like they're super normal and we just want women not to die, right? That's their messaging. And Republicans say, well, they're the extremists, but we're not going to be super clear about what we want. Meanwhile, they're actually quite, you know, they're incrementalists who are very much in line with what, or could be much, very much in line with what the average American is willing to support. So it's almost like we're playing with the house's money, but we don't know it.
Yeah, no, that's good. I'm glad to say that here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, we have a number of state legislatures that have advanced the pro-life cause through public policy. For example, one bill would require fathers to begin paying child support at conception. If it's confirmed that that man is the father of that child, and if he's not married to the mother, then they would be required under law to support that child. Now, the sponsor of it was not prepared for the pushback that she got against it. But in principle, it acknowledges the truth that, number one, there's a child there. Number two, that the father should be responsible for caring for that child and caring for the mother as well. Alexandra, another bill would have supported women who conceived in rape. It would have allowed her and the child to be on Medicaid. It would have provided for schooling for that child and other support. So again, it was the state in this proposal was coming together, coming around the woman, supporting her and her child in a very difficult pregnancy. And that bill has gone forward as well. Not sure if it's going to make it into law, but we have seen some positive steps where the pro-life movement is taking it to that next level. We're no longer just trying to get rid of Roe v. Wade. That's history. But now we are finding ourselves having to help the women in difficult pregnancies, help the woman who has been sexually assaulted and conceives. And I think this is what you've said in some of your writings. How do we further the pro-life cause in these other areas?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really encouraging to hear about. It's interesting that first bill you mentioned with the fathers having to support children from conception. I remember, I think a year or two before Dobbs came out, there was a similar bill proposed in Oklahoma by a Democrat who said basically, look, if this is what they want, if this is what they think, we should at least have, you know, children being supported by their fathers. And he actually was, you know, shamed and attacked so hard by abortion supporters and much more progressive people on his own side to the point that he withdrew the bill. And so that's kind of another point where you see, look, Republicans are wanting these kinds of laws. We want to support children. We want to support mothers. The other side won't do it if they think it undermines their principles, right? They don't want to acknowledge there's a child there at the moment of conception. So that was discouraging to see that. I hope now that Dobbs has happened, more Democrats will be willing to support laws like that. But that really is where we have to be, because outlawing abortion is not going to stop abortion. It's necessary. You know, right now we have to pass laws to protect unborn children, certainly. But we also have to create a culture where women don't want abortion, because even if it is illegal, women are going to find ways. We talk about chemical abortion. Women who want abortions are going to find a way to do it. And the point is, we should be having a culture where women realize abortion is not their only option. And in fact, abortion is bad for them and will help them not have to choose that. We'll help people who think abortion is their only choice realize that there are much better options out there. And I think having fathers support children is a really, really big one.
So that's one thing. But what are some other things that can be done to have a culture that encourages childbearing, that supports women, a culture that acknowledges that abortion does not solve anything, but it harms women, it harms families, it harms society? What are some other things that can be done, whether in the public policy realm or in the at the family level, church level? Are there some other recommendations that you have if we want to move towards a culture of life?
Yeah, it's hard. There's many different facets to that. I think one big one is, look, we send a lot of money, you know, at the national level and at the state level to Planned Parenthood, you know, under the auspices of this being a women's healthcare organization. Of course, we know better, it's an abortion organization, but why isn't that equal amount of money going to places that actually support women who want to keep their children, right? If a woman who's pregnant and wants to keep her child walks into Planned Parenthood, no one has anything for her there, right? There's no help. But there are thousands of people, or thousands of centers, far more than abortion clinics in our country, who are willing to support women like that when their family or the father of the child won't do so. We should be supporting them equally, at least, to how we support abortion clinics financially. Another idea would be teach children in schools, if we have to have all these different sex ed programs, you know, we might have quibbles with them, teach them about fetal development. Do children know when a child develops a heartbeat? Do they know, when a child has fingernails? Just these different things to help people realize this is a human being in the womb, right? And it's, acting in a way that could bring this person into the world is a serious thing, right? Just having sex with whomever and then kind of going to get an abortion is not a responsible way to conduct yourself. That's not a virtuous way to conduct yourself, to teach kids that. Even if we have pro-abortion laws still, I think that would go a long way. And that translates to the church context, the family context, right? How do we talk about sex? How do we talk about human life in the womb? Do kids really understand this is serious? This is real.
That is good. To your point about teaching fetal development in sex ed classes, there's a bill in the Kentucky legislature. It's called the Baby Olivia Act, and it would teach fetal development from the embryonic stage to the ninth month in utero. And that bill is getting traction as well. So I'm so proud of our state legislature. We've got a number of pro-life advocates who have taken the lead on important things here. If I could add one other thing, I think that we can do better, whether in the church or in the family context, it is to cast a vision for the goodness of family, the goodness of marriage between a man and a woman, the goodness of them bringing new life into the world. Just this whole idea of how our Creator made us, right? We're made male and female, and God made us to not be alone, although singleness is for some, and that's a gift for some, but for most of us, no. And I think that so many of the messages today, Alexandra, militate against this idea of family and commitment in marriage and fidelity and child raising. Much of what we see on Hollywood militates against that. We see extramarital affairs or single people hooking up regularly and child rearing is just a drag, right? These are the messages that we get in day in and day out. And somehow I would suggest that we need to cast a vision for what the good life is and what wholeness is and what the beauty in raising children, right? I don't know where we begin. Maybe the church, but we do need to begin with that, don't we?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think you're exactly right about that, because abortion really is a symptom of a deeper cultural problem, right? We don't see human life as being good. We don't see sex as being, in, at the very least, in a relationship of real commitment between a man and woman, but ideally it belongs in marriage, right, between husband and wife. And in that context, when children come into the world, well, the mother and father are already committed to one another, and then they are committed to caring for the child who comes into the world. And in that context, if we had a culture like that, people wouldn't want abortion, right? It would be quite rare and much easier to support the few women here and there that were the exception. Now, as to how we bring that back, I don't know, but I do think pro-lifers have to see building that kind of culture as being inextricable from ending abortion.
I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the Alabama Supreme Court ruling that acknowledged that frozen human embryos are indeed human beings. How has this ruling impacted the pro-life movement?
Well, I think there have been a lot of misinterpretations, both willful and otherwise, of the ruling. I think a lot of malicious folks on the other side have tried to argue that this means the pro-life movement suddenly wants to ban IVF tomorrow. In reality, the suit was a wrongful death lawsuit, right? It was not a criminal suit about IVF in any way. But I do think it is a beautiful thing that came out of it that, yeah, we are going to recognize these are human beings. And we're really in a kind of a bit of a conundrum as a country with all these frozen embryos everywhere who are human beings, deserving of dignity. What do we do? Where do we go from here? But I think it's a good chance for us to remember and to state as pro-lifers that children are not commodities, right? We're not, we don't just get to manufacture kids at will and keep them frozen at will and have them at will. They're not like a nice prize that you get if you're an adult who wants one, or, something kind of a piece of trash you get rid of if you don't want the kid. That's a really evil way to look at human life.
And that's something that really hasn't been thought of much lately or considered deeply. Maybe at the beginning when IVF was legalized and when we had the technology some 40, maybe 50 years ago, I think is when it developed. There were conversations largely led by the Catholic Church, Catholic thinkers on this, because we're talking about the creation of a new human life outside of the conjugal union of a man and a woman. And now we have the technology to create human beings in a lab. And as a result, we have perhaps in the millions of frozen embryos all across the country at these IVF clinics. And it wasn't until this ruling, until somebody allowed these human embryos to perish. And I don't know if it was willful or if it was neglect by the IVF center. In either case, this ruling that said that these are human beings and the parents that whose offspring these were, they were damaged, they were harmed. But this really has brought this discussion back up. Now, this is a whole, this is related to the pro-life movement, but it definitely is an important conversation for us to have. I want to get to one other important development before we wrap this up. CVS and Walgreens announced that they're going to be selling mifepristone in some states. Now, this is a big development. They've not carried this before. Previously, I think that the chemical abortion drugs would have had to been obtained from an abortion clinic. What does this mean to the pro-life movement? You've got two of the biggest pharmacies that are going to be distributing this life-ending drug.
Yeah, well, this definitely goes hand in hand with the kind of concern we talked about earlier that chemical abortions are now the majority and moving towards the supermajority of all abortions in America. And they're a lot harder to regulate than a surgical abortion, right? You can shut down abortion clinics pretty easily if you pass pro-life laws. But it's a lot harder to stop women from ordering on Walgreens if they have, the appropriate permit from a doctor or whatever it is you need. That's a lot harder to regulate. And so it really drives home, I think, for the pro-life movement that we need better laws. On one hand, we need to figure out good ways to enforce these laws if we have laws against chemical abortion. But also, we need to figure out ways to make it so that fewer women want abortions in the first place. Because again, if you can get these anywhere via the mail, the most effective way to stop those abortions is by helping women not want them, or helping to build a culture where women realize that's not an option, that's actually a good thing for them or their child.
Alexandra, this has been a fantastic program. You're a great guest. You bring a wealth of knowledge. I feel like we need to do this again. Maybe in a few months or later in the year, you can give us an update. Maybe after the election, we can maybe analyze and see what happened with the pro-life movement at the ballot box. But we know too that this is a long game. We don't win this just one election at a time. It's over several elections over a long period of time. And I appreciate what you're doing. Again, Alexandra DeSantis, author of Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. Been great to have you on as a guest. And thank you all for tuning in. If you can go to your favorite podcast platform and rate us, please do. And then also tell your friends about us. This is a great way to introduce the Commonwealth Matters to them as well. Thank you all for joining us, and may God bless you.